people in the future whose education and development is for things as they are. The rise of the computer industry shows us one dimension. Things are changing very rapidly, and that which is a current fact today may be an absurdity tomorrow. It has happened many times in the past. But actually, while we cannot hope to diagnose in detail the future, we have no reason to hope that the advancement and even the perfection of computerization will have any particular effect upon human morality and ethics. It will only supply another tool for human beings to abuse. And this is the thing we all have to face, the danger of misusing anything that we call progress. Progress will be exploited as long as humanly possible. And this exploitation will continue as long as an educated, scientifically trained humanity remains colossally ignorant. This type of situation cannot produce any permanent result in the future. If all we ever do is find new ways of commercializing what we call advancement and progress. We are in the midst, therefore, of a situation in which the only possible answer lies in the changing of policy. The changes must come here if they are to affect things which belong here and will remain here. The individual himself must begin to plan and build a future. He must decide what he wants to do, for example, with the rest of his present years. So for many people, the first step in the problem of the future is to plan the next 10 or 20 years. What is the person going to do in this present situation? He probably would like to believe or hope that in these 20 years that he may have, he will not be under constant stress and strain of present world crises. He does not want to live these years with a fear of nuclear warfare hanging over his head. He does not want to look forward to a time in which there is no longer any petroleum, or that various essential industries go out of existence from bankruptcy. He does not want to look upon a financial situation which goes into some kind of a spiral nosedive and results in the wiping out of the economic security of millions of human beings. These things he does not want to look forward to. And yet, what can he really do to prevent this from happening, if it does? The only thing he can learn to do is very much what Emerson was told back in New England years ago. Someone said to him, "Dr. Emerson, if the world ends, what will you do?" And Emerson thought for a couple of minutes rather quietly. He said, "Well, I guess I'll have to get along without it." Now, there are ways in which we may have to get along without things that we thought we wanted. We are going to be forced to create a new source of strength. We are going to have to move security from the bank and the building loan to the heart and soul in ourselves. We will have to build our security upon invisibles, upon those integrities which are there by divine insight. We will have to return the world very largely to the spiritual foundations upon which it was originally built. We are going to have to allow the divine plan to operate and take our refuge in that, to take our refuge in the law, rather than in the dangers and insecurities of present living. We may have to face these insecurities any day, but if we have a solid internal foundation, we will be able to survive any external crisis, because we know we are in a universe of law and love and order. We are not aware of this love and order because we are ourselves blocking it. But there is nothing in the divine plan of things that says that man will destroy himself. But there are many things in the divine plan which say man will sicken himself until he realizes he has to free his consciousness from these destructive factors and elements. One of the things that we will all have to face in the course of time, whether it's now or in the future, is a considerable simplification of living. As the population of the earth increases and natural resources decrease, the individual will find it absolutely essential to change his mode of life. The profit system as we know it today cannot survive the end of our resources and our basic natural wealth. If we exhaust the major sources of wealth, we cannot continue to use wealth as the basis of our calculations. We are going to have to learn to find out that the great profit that there is the profit of growth, the profit of hope, and the profit of simple, gentle, cooperative ways. I know many people who say they would love to be students. They'd like to think about things. They'd like to release their artistic instincts or do all kinds of creative self-expressions. But they cannot because of the pressures of circumstances around them. Nature is going to remove those external pressures as rapidly as the individual is willing to dedicate himself to the release of his own internal integrities. The individual is responsible. He is responsible because in the very heart and soul of himself, he is convinced that visible things are real. Therefore, he wants all he can have of them. Invisible things he's not sure of. And if he must sacrifice something, he will sacrifice that which he does not know to the accumulation of that which he wants. This type of thinking has always more or less dominated human relationships. But it is getting to the point where it cannot endure forever. We are on a very technically critical point in our development of future policies. Everything in the future is going to run to simplification. The age of complication is just reaching its exhaustion. As every factor we know diminishes, and as all things finally reduce themselves to the basic essentials, we will find that the human being is here for one purpose only, and that is to perfect his inner nature. He is here to grow. He is here to become and not to gain through accumulation. The accumulation is very clearly mentioned in most of the scriptures of the world as a false objective, and it is. Accumulation is not going to solve any problem that we have. What is going to solve the problem is the individual changing his standards of values. If a person wants to be wise, really sincerely, he has a very interesting possibility. In the first place, no matter how wise he becomes, no one else will ever be deprived of the smallest part of wisdom. It's not something that is in short supply. The trouble is, it's in short demand. Love is something that is also available to all. And it is available without limiting anyone else. Because if love is selfish and tries to control other people, it isn't love at all. But all of the great virtues and integrities, wisdom, understanding, skills of all kinds, are non-competitive. They are things which exist and always will exist and will be available to anyone who wants to use them. The great painter, as he becomes a greater and greater artist, does not forbid others to become artists. He has his day, he leaves his treasures, and others come after him. The great truths of life, the beauties of life, the wisdoms of life are all universal. The Greeks had an understanding of this, perhaps better than we do, because they did not consider, for example, an art like architecture to be merely a mechanical, mathematical series of formulas. They rather considered architecture to be a being, a living thing in somehow. And they gave a muse to it who was the personification of architecture. They gave another muse, Urania, to be the patroness of astronomy. But these deities were mysterious things, because if an art is great, or a science is great, how can it be communicated? How can it be shared? How can it grow and become subject to moral and ethical laws unless somewhere within that thing itself is a life principle of its own? The ancients believed that all the arts and sciences were the bodies of soul beings, invisible creatures, beings, that had existence of themselves. They came and favored noted exponents. They became the patrons of the great artificers of the past. But all these arts are living things. And every true art and science is not only alive, but it is a moral entity. Every art or science that exists will destroy that which corrupts it. If it is misused, it will turn upon the one who abuses it. If it is used falsely, it will destroy itself and those who practice it falsely. For each art, science, way of life, every problem that a human being needs is controlled by law. And everything helps if it is used, punishes if it is abused. Therefore, we are not dealing in any way with things that have no souls or no beings within themselves. The Chinese knew this. They realized that in some mysterious way, everything that is beautiful and wonderful has a soul. Arithmetic has a soul. History has a soul. But if we continue them to only as being mental agencies of our own creation, we have no way of controlling them. What we do not realize is that these beings exist long beyond our lifespan. Art has been with us from the beginning and will be with us to the end. It has come largely in proper form to those who used it wisely. Those who wanted to exploit art nearly always missed being great artists. The art that is exploited turns upon the one who exploits it. And when a world develops an art based upon selfishness and cupidity, that art begins to tarnish the reputation not only of the artist, but of the whole civilization. Nations have fallen because they lost the realization of beauty and integrity. So all of these departments, according to the ancients, were alive, really beings. And as such, they were of the greatest significance and value to those who served them wisely. Every great exponent of knowledge is a dedicated person. And according to the measure of the dedication, such will be the measure of the accomplishment. So we have to recognize that in building the future, that there are two futures to be considered. Our personal future, which has been in our own hands since the beginning and always will be. And the collective future, which is fashioned gradually out of groups of persons who have achieved individual integrity. The golden age we look for is an age in which individuals themselves have been converted to the principles of integrity and honor. Until that time, the struggle must go on. We've seen what happens in all different walks of life with the exploitation and abuse and misuse of resources. We know also that misuse has a wide aura around it. Misuse results in the spread of defeatism. It causes the rest of the world to wonder if anything is any good. It causes us to doubt those closest to us, simply because under the present system, ulterior motives may show anywhere. Now, nature has ways of helping this situation along. Nature says that where integrity fails in a nation, the collapse of that nation is inevitable. If integrity fails in the individual, his own problems become unbearable. There is no question in the world that a person who abuses, misuses, or neglects the proper use of his own faculties is going to suffer physically as a result. A large part of sickness today is the result of nature reminding us that we're not doing it right. Sickness, in many ways, is inevitable among those who go around criticizing and condemning, running up acidity at a great rate, who are locking their minds to true progress, and in this way destroying the proper eliminational processes of the body. In every case, the person who does not live right will suffer from the consequences of living badly. This constitutes an incredible rise in every type of psychological ailment. We are a race today of nervous wrecks, not because anything is really that bad, but because our reactions to the problems that need solution are so poor and so helpless and hopeless that they continue to contribute to our discomfort. Years ago, there was quite a furor of thinking on a constructive level. The idea that the mind should think hopefully on most every situation that arises. That the mind should reaffirm to itself constantly that deity is in its heavens and all is basically right with the world. And the part we don't like about it is part of the rightness we've got to learn to understand. But gradually, this idea of trying to see good in things has been turned into a kind of a Pollyanna attitude in which we don't think things through, we just simply gush a little optimism. Actually, however, if we have to do something, I think we should try more and more to cultivate the tendency to seek for and find something constructive in the things that happen to us. Sometimes that's going to be difficult. Sometimes it may be impossible at the present stage of our integration. But in many small matters, at least, it is perfectly possible to view difficulties as opportunities. The day when we didn't want the visitor and the visitor showed up is an opportunity not to be disconcerted or irritable, but to hunt for some new value that we are going to share with that other person or they're going to share with us. Everything that happens can have some kind of meaning if we are looking for that. If, on the other hand, we are aware only of what is wrong and neglect all else, we are much in the condition that was described by Socrates in his allegory or parable of the glass of water. Socrates had a glass half filled with water, and he explained to his disciples that an optimist looking at the half glass of water would say that it is half full. The pessimist would say it is half empty, but it is the same. Now, the pessimist in life is the individual who sees the empty side. The optimist is the one who sees the fullness of some part of it. And each of us could begin to develop a little optimism about things we can control. We can become a little wiser managers of our own affairs and lives. We can become a little more self-reliant. We can control our appetite so that we do not unnecessarily support values which are not good. All around, this is going to have to happen. Now, actually, if we begin to be discriminating, this will result in a considerable conservation of natural resources. If the individual is thrifty, is economical, practical, and careful, does not fall for all the glowing advertisements with which he is surrounded, if he lives within a reasonable pattern of responsibilities and financial integrities, he will save considerable money, and he will also have more time to do constructive thinking. We are now tied to the idea of enjoyment that we really believe that this world was created just for fun. And that's the strange part of it, is that everybody says it's funny, but very few people are having any fun. What we call fun is desperate extravagance of one kind or another to make up for a constant boredom within ourselves. So if we go into the future now, what kind of a future are we going to visualize? Because we have to visualize something, or it will not happen. Now, each person can have his own future, because each individual has hopes that are his own. But various systems of thought and so forth have had prophetic attitudes on this problem of the future. In the prophecies of Nostradamus, he brings into focus the Paraclete, or the Prince of Peace, and he says that this being, or this principle, it doesn't necessarily have to be a person, any more than arithmetic has to be a person, but it is alive. But the Paraclete, or the principle of world peace, should arise among the nations of human society shortly after the end of the present century. That in the beginning of the 21st century, there will be a major variation in our policies. That we will by that time reach a condition in which we will realize that true joy, true happiness, true insights and understandings are being completely blocked by what we call success. And as a result of that, success is destroying society. But Nostradamus was convinced that there was going to be a great reformation of human society. That the way of the future was inevitable, not only from the standpoint of prophecy, but from the standpoint of analysis of the physical facts of living. That gradually and inevitably, humanity is going to accept the destiny for which it was originally intended. And that destiny was to understand and unfold internal potential. That this is going to become the great fad of the future. That it's going to gradually take away from us all the miseries and misfortunes of our modern educational system. It is going to put education where it belongs, a dedication to discovering those things which will contribute most and most immediately to the improvement of humanity. That education is not going to be merely theoretical. That the education will include a means of culturing the inner life so that the soul, for the first time, can show its face in this world. These changes must come, and everyone in their own heart and soul would dream of a future in which the evils we know would no longer exist. Well, if the evils no longer exist, there's only one reason for that. We will have cured them. We are hoping maybe the sky will open and some mysterious divine power will wipe out calamities and bestow upon us joys which we have not earned. This seems rather remote. The power that will bring us the golden age, the divine principle, which we hope will come to us, must come through us. We must make our own dedications and our own associations with life and make them so that they will endure and carry on. Actually, we have another interesting problem in our dimensions of time. And this particular phase of it is pretty well discussed and thought through by the Greek mathematicians. That is today, now. Tomorrow will be the past. What was today the future will tomorrow be the present. All of these time patterns, under the guidance of wise old Cronus with his scythe and hourglass, the whole problem is relative. We are in the moment only at this moment, as Zen points out. There is a now, and strangely enough, this now is a forever in itself. All past and future are flowing around the concept of the only reality, which is now. The past is gone, dead, a dream. The future is unlived and to a large measure unknowable and is merely the abstract substance of things hoped for. Past and future are strange, intangible divisions of eternal time. Now is the moment that is of the greatest significance and is the great reality. For things that happen must happen now. Regardless of when that now is, they must happen in the very presence of a reality. Therefore, things that happen that are solutional are real. Those things which are hopes or fears are not real. The reality is now and the conduct of our own lives now. Everything that is important to us must impel us to immediate action. It must give us the courage to make the changes in ourselves in the only dimension that is real, now. Actually, now will be the moment when we make them. It's the question as to whether the now or the making of them comes first. But at the moment we do it, we come to now. Until we do it, we are in fantasy. We are in fantasy as long as we say, tomorrow I will be better. Well, we also will be in fantasy when we say, yesterday I was worse. The only realities are those which are associated with the immediate accomplishment of necessary changes. And for the individual, the accomplishment of necessary changes begins when he decides to make them. The moment he makes these decisions and puts them into action, he changes both the past and the future. Of the past, he escapes from its terrors. Of the future, he builds foundations under its hopes. The person was, is, and will be according to the motion of his own consciousness through the past, the present, and toward the future. Therefore, we all want a better future. To many religious people, the better future is a world beyond the grave, in which things are beautiful, in which all the sorrows and miseries of this life are left behind. But there is more to it than that. The individual moving into any dimension of life, here or hereafter, must take with him what he is. And until what he is compatible with his hopes, he will not find the peace, happiness, and understanding that he desires. I think then that perhaps no time before have we had the skills to estimate the future as well as we could now. We now have the facilities of measuring the commodities of life. We know how much oil there is still in the ground. We know what life forms are becoming extinct. We know everything that is necessary to the gradual acceptance of the challenge of that which is right. We don't have to wait until the last tree is gone before we decide it's time to save the timber. It is no longer necessary for us to reach a point where the only locomotion possible is a bicycle because the oil is all gone. We should not have to face these emergencies in this way. If we begin by conserving, we begin also by turning creativity into new channels of solution. As long as we can get away with what we're doing, things will not change. But the moment we begin to see the values must change, minds will begin to find ways of changing constructively. We can live indefinitely on this planet if we gain the full insight of how to do it. We are not going to be bound to the things we now have forever. We are not going to be subject to the calamities of international relations forever. We are gradually going to solve these things, but we must begin to solve them now. The individual and the nation must begin to take stock of available futures, of available things that must be worked with, and then settle down at last to the way of working with them, which will produce the results that we need. There is no reason why humanity should ever starve. There are many, many forms of food and many ways of maintaining the body that we know nothing of today. There's no reason why we should not be able to fulfill our life expectancies, even if we do not have all the commodities. Because within man are the powers to adapt to anything that is necessary to his survival. The more he depends upon the external, the more frightened he will be. But the more he realizes the potential to solve, which is within himself, and that he can solve anything that he needs to solve, that he can accomplish whatever is necessary to his own survival. For life is going to be preserved from within himself, and by the release of his own soul power, by the release of his own understanding, and his natural affections and regards, little by little, as every commodity fails, something will take its place. But that something will be better, because it will have to be from a different level than that of an exhausted planet. It has to be the power of consciousness, of life, and of soul, not only for the individual to save himself, but to save his world along with him. Everything that is necessary to us is available. But it is only accessible to us if we no longer block every part of our lives with a very foolish sense of competition. As long as business as usual controls the world, business as usual will end in bankruptcy. But when we use these various facilities not to make profit from them, but to apply them to our needs as nature intended, we will find that out of a powerful, cooperative commune of effort, we will not only continue the planet, but we will find new healing powers, we will find new length of life, new opportunities for true joy, more pleasure for ourselves, more security for our children. All these things are possible because none of them are primarily part of the physical plan of things. They are all part of the inner life, which has to come out. When the inner life comes out, the material body and its conditions will be properly solved. But all solution to the problems of our time must begin within ourselves. And they will begin when the outside is no longer adequate. We will not face these values until we have to. But when we have to face them, we will. And when we do face them, we will find that our fears were all imaginary. It is really important to know that within each of these little atoms that we call elements now, in each is a spark that is strong enough to tear the world apart. It is also strong enough to put together all the weaknesses of existence. There is more energy in an atom than we would require to maintain this world for a million years. So we've got to learn how. But we've also got to realize that in learning how, we must do it with love and affection and understanding, and our motivation must be to save and to serve, and not to accumulate and to foreclose on each other. If we use the powers that we have and gradually release what is available, we have nothing to worry about the future. We have already found to our final contentment that there is no use worrying about the past. Nothing is needed to perfect the future. What is necessary is a good hard job right now, getting hold of things and doing that which ensures us our proper place in the universal plan of things. If we achieve this, we have nothing really to worry about, because after all, we are here for a little while, but we're in eternity forever. We come back and fill worlds, we become people, we return again into the divine spheres from which we came. We are here to live and to grow and to love and to serve. And if we follow those rules, the past will become beautiful, the present will become meaningful, and the future will become inevitable goodness for all concerned. We just have to get to work and do the best we can with it. Thanks a lot.